talk. I've been a practicing lawyer and a law professor for, I guess, about 40 years, mainly in Charleston, South Carolina. Now admitted to practice in New York, and actually we live in D.C., and I'm admitted to practice in D.C. as well. Most of my practice has focused on the law of lawyering and lawyers' ethics. I do a fair amount of expert witnessing work and advice to law firms and things of that kind. My partner, Francesca Giannone Crystal, is an international lawyer and does international transactions, mergers and acquisitions, and technology-related work. So I have some information about the firm, which I can pass out to you after the talk. So the focus of this talk is on, and just by way of introduction, if you think back 5 or 10 years about what the practice of law was like, and think about the practice of law today, and think about how much technology is affecting the practice of law, it's truly extraordinary. And if you think even further about it, I think it's clear that we're only at the beginning of these developments. And I don't think any of us can see what the future is going to be like, but the technology and the practice of law are going to be intimately intertwined with one another. Francesca and I wrote an article about cloud computing and a number of ethics and practical issues related to cloud computing. And if you're interested in that, I'd be happy to share that with you as well. But today's talk is about social media, and in particular the use of social media to gather information in litigation, but also some advertising issues related to social media. But I'm happy to answer questions or try to answer questions on any of these topics. First, I'll talk for about maybe 10 or 15 minutes, and then we can have a question and answer session. So first, with regard to gathering information, and there are lots of permutations and combinations here, because you can have information gathering from a party to a lawsuit. The party may be represented or unrepresented. You could have information gathering from a witness who may be represented or unrepresented. You could have information about jurors. And the rules in some respects are similar with these different categories, and in other respects are different. So let me just talk about these different types of situations. I can give some examples, and we can see where this leads us. First of all, if you take the situation of a party to a lawsuit, and that party wants to gather information about the other party and use the social media sites that the other party may be using, what are the ethical rules that apply to that situation? So first of all, if it's the lawyer who is on behalf of the client is attempting to access social media sites and gather information, the basic rule that applies there is New York Rule of Professional Conduct 4.2. And that rule basically says you cannot communicate with a person who is represented by counsel in the matter unless it's authorized by law or unless you have the consent of the other lawyer. So a basic prohibition about communication. That raises the question of when you are accessing social media sites of an adverse party, when do you have a communication? And the ethics rules around the country, there's an ABA rule to this effect, and there's some New York rules, and this is in the guidelines as well, that the public portion of a social media site of the adverse party, you can freely access that without any problem. The only qualification that comes into that is what happens if the adverse party is notified through the infrastructure of the social media site that a person has been viewing their site and who that person may be. That may or may not be viewed as a communication. And here there is some difference between the New York approach and the ABA approach. There was an ABA ethics opinion just this year, ABA opinion 466, that said where you have a public portion of a social media site and a lawyer on behalf of a client accesses that on behalf of the client, but not through the action of the lawyer, but through the action of the site, that the adverse party is informed of that access and perhaps can find out or is told of who the person is that's accessing the site. That, under the ABA's view, was not a communication by the lawyer representing the adverse party. It was treated as a communication by the site, but not by the lawyer. The New York approach is different on that. The New York approach is that if the other person, if the lawyer who is accessing the site knows that this information will be conveyed to the adverse party, that would be viewed as a communication. So the New York approach is more restrictive than that. And if you look in the guidelines, Guideline 3C, viewing a represented party's restricted social media website, a lawyer shall not contact a represented person to seek to review the restricted portion. Well, that's the restricted portion. We're talking about the unrestricted portion, 3A. A lawyer may view the public portion of a person's social media profile or public post, even if such person is represented by another lawyer. However, the lawyer must be aware that certain social media networks may send an automatic message to the person whose account is being viewed, which identifies the person viewing the account as well as other information about such person. And that, under New York opinions, may well be viewed as a communication. Now, what can you do to protect yourself against that being viewed as a communication? Well, first of all, Facebook seems to be relatively safe in this regard, because at least the current policies of Facebook is that they will not notify a person whose site is being viewed as to who it is that has viewed the site. In fact, I understand Facebook policy to be, even if you tried to get it, they view it, if there's an app that will allow that, they want to know about it, and they'll bar the app from having access to their site. So I think if you use Facebook, at least under their current policies, you're relatively safe. However, you need to keep aware of what Facebook policies may be, because one of the obligations a lawyer has in the technology area is to keep abreast of changes in technology. And if Facebook were to change its policy, or if there became, let's say, a widespread app that could identify that information, then I think you have a different situation. But right now, with regard to Facebook, it looks like you could freely look at the public portion, and there would be no risk that there would be disclosure to the adverse party and therefore a violation of Rule 4.2. LinkedIn is a little bit different, because LinkedIn will notify the party of a viewing of the site, but as a someone who is viewing the site, you can prevent that from occurring by setting your privacy settings so that it doesn't convey the information to the adverse party. So if you're going to use LinkedIn, you need to take the step of setting your privacy settings to prevent that disclosure to the adverse party. And in terms of supervision of lawyers and non-lawyers in the firm, if you're using an investigator or if another lawyer is doing this access as a supervisory responsibility, you need to make sure that if they're doing a LinkedIn access, that the privacy settings are properly set to prevent disclosure of who it is that's doing the access. So,
I have a question.
Yes.
Regarding Facebook, or procuring information from Facebook, if I were to hire a private investigator wholly separate from my firm, who happens to friend the person that we're investigating, is that okay if I were to present that? Are there ethical implications?
Yes, there are. So the first principle is that an agent of the lawyer can't do anything that the lawyer couldn't do. So if you hire the investigator, and actually one of the guidelines speaks to that point. If you look at Yeah, 3D. I'm sorry, you're right. Lawyers' use of agents to contact a represented party. As it relates to viewing a person's social media account, a lawyer shall not order or direct an agent to engage in specific conduct or with knowledge of the specific conduct by such person ratify it, where such conduct, if engaged in by the lawyer, would violate any ethics rules. So if you directed the investigator to only view the public portions, fine, because the public portions, you could access those. But if you direct the investigator to friend the person, that would clearly be a communication, which the lawyer couldn't do, and accordingly the investigator couldn't do it, and the lawyer would be responsible. If the lawyer directed the investigator to do it, the lawyer would be responsible. If the lawyer failed to inform the investigator that you couldn't do it, the lawyer would be responsible.
How about the automatic messages in that case, if you've got an agent, so, you know, it's not going so proactively as friending, but something would be triggered and the person wouldn't know that that is a lawyer's agent who's triggered that automatic notice, like on LinkedIn or something like that.
Yeah, I don't think it matters that the person doesn't know that it's the lawyer's agent. So if in fact they are informed that this person had made the contact, even though they might not know it's the lawyer's agent, if the lawyer gathered the information through the use of that investigator, there'd be a problem. I mean, but it'd be much like the situation where, let's say, an investigator knocks on the door of the adverse party and says, you know, I'm a home salesperson and wants to talk with them and gather some information. Maybe they don't know that it has anything to do with the lawsuit, but the fact that the lawyer authorized it, ratified it, and maybe even benefited from it, the lawyer would be responsible.
How far back does this chain go? If I Google a defendant's name, some of the postings that I'm going to have are going to disclose information in just the first blurb from different websites. Do I have any responsibility ethically with regard to that? It would seem to be public knowledge then.
Yeah, I think that's all public knowledge. I think just a general Google search doesn't constitute a communication at all. And the guidelines speak to general research and basically say general research is fine so long as it doesn't rise to the level of a communication. Now, I don't particularly agree with the New York view that if there is a communication to a recipient that someone has viewed the site and that person is acting on behalf of a lawyer, that constitutes a communication. I'm in agreement with the ABA view, because I don't think we should unduly restrict evidence gathering through social media. And I don't think if you are trying to access public information, just because the other person happens to know that some person has accessed that and maybe they can identify that it relates to a lawyer, nonetheless, it's public information. I don't think that should be restricted. So I'm not really in harmony with the New York view, but so be it. That's the New York view.
Are you aware of any challenges to that?
Not aware of any. Those are ethics opinions. Yeah. The courts might not accept it.
Uh-huh. And some people are also more set up to, you know, be aware of what's happening, out there on, say, their own website, if they have Google Analytics or something like that. And there's no way to know really how well informed and set up those people are.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. The result is, because you don't know how well informed they are, for cautionary lawyers, it puts a chilling effect on using even public social media to gather information. I don't think you should do that. Now, in terms of the non-public portion of the site, that pretty clearly, if a lawyer or an investigator acting on behalf of a lawyer tried to gain access by being a friend to the non-public portion, that would clearly be a communication and would be considered improper in New York and considered improper generally. That's guideline 3C.
But we're talking about parties to a litigation.
Parties to a litigation.
Not necessarily a witness in a case.
Well, the Rule 4.2 applies outside the litigation setting because it applies to communication with someone represented by counsel in a matter. And so it wouldn't necessarily be limited to litigation. So let's say you had a business transaction and
right.
You wanted to, you know, look at the social media sites of the other people who were involved in the transaction, maybe potential purchasers or something like that, and you wanted to, if you tried to access the private portions, I think you'd have a problem under Rule 4.2.
I guess I'm I'm struggling with the comparing this with the scenario of a witness who voluntarily accepts a friend request from, you know, ex parte, which some people do indiscriminately.
Well, witnesses are different. Just talking about parties
right now.
Right,
okay.
Yeah. Witnesses we'll talk about in just a minute. But if it's a party represented by counsel, then 4.2 clearly is implicated under these set of rules that I'm talking about. Now, let's take another situation, which is, let's suppose the adverse party is represented by counsel, and so we know now what the rules are with regard to the lawyer trying to gain access or information from the social media sites. But what if the client wants to do it without the participation of the lawyer? Then the rules are a little bit different, because 4.2 only applies to communications by the lawyer. It also says that a lawyer, and I'll quote the language here, New York Rule of Professional Conduct 4.2b says, notwithstanding the prohibitions of paragraph A, which is the one dealing with no communication with a represented party, and unless prohibited by law, a lawyer may cause a client to communicate with a represented person unless the represented person is not legally competent, and may counsel the client with respect to such communications, provided the lawyer gives reasonable advance notice to the represented person's counsel that such communication will be taking place. Now, so first of all, if the client, on the client's own, accesses the media site, even engages in misrepresentation to do so, the lawyer is not going to be responsible for that misrepresentation unless the lawyer was a party to it in some fashion. And in fact, I think the lawyer could even use the information that was gained through deceit by the client, so long as the lawyer wasn't a participant in it. The lawyer might feel uncomfortable doing that, and you could certainly see the other side filing a motion to exclude the evidence, and there can be collateral issues that develop here. But in terms of ethical conduct, the client has got the right to communicate with the other side if they want to without counsel being present. They have the right to access social media sites, to try to be a friend to a site, and even, you know, people use all sorts of misrepresentations with regard to social media, and that in itself is not a crime or anything of that kind. If the client is doing it, it's not an ethical violation of the lawyer doing it. Now, what this rule seems to say is the lawyer cannot cause the client to communicate or counsel the client to communicate with a represented party unless you notify the other party. So if the lawyer were to say to the client, look, I know there's valuable stuff on the social media site of the defendant. Why don't you, you know, do some misrepresentation, get access to that site, and so on. The lawyer in that case is causing the client to engage in improper conduct and also is not informing the other side. That, I think, would be improper under this rule. It'd be improper under the rule that you can't do indirectly through somebody else what you can't do yourself. But if the client does this on the client's own and the lawyer doesn't participate, I think that's fine in terms of the client gathering information. Now, suppose the client comes to you and says, would it be helpful to our case if I tried to friend the other side and gather information? Lawyer can't counsel the client about doing that, because if you can't counsel the client by saying, wow, that would be great, we'd get all sorts of valuable information, I think you trigger Rule 4.2b and probably trigger an obligation to inform the other side that this is going to take place, in which case it's of no value whatsoever. But if you say to the client, well, I can't tell you one way or the other about that, I can't counsel you ethically, I can't advise you to do this, I can't help you in any way, I think the client may well get the message and do it anyway, and you may get the information, so long as you don't take the step of going over the line and assisting or directing or encouraging the client to do it.
Yeah, what if a lawyer communicates with a party in litigation who's not represented?
Okay, so that was actually the next step I was going to get to. What do you do if it is an unrepresented person? In that case, 4.2 doesn't come into play because that only applies if the person is represented by counsel. 4.3 is the rule that deals with unrepresented parties. And as to unrepresented parties, it says you have an obligation not to mislead them. You have an obligation to make sure they don't misunderstand what your role is. You can't give them any kind of legal advice. This probably comes up more often with witnesses than it does with adverse parties. If the witness says, you know, you're talking with the witness and the witness says, well, I don't know what the legal implications of this are. Can you tell me what would be the consequences of my doing this? Then they're seeking legal advice and they're an adverse party and you shouldn't do that under rule 4.3. Now, what the guidelines say about this is they seem to elaborate to some degree on this concept of not engaging in misrepresentation to an unrepresented party. Excuse me. Guideline 3B, contacting an unrepresented party. A lawyer may request permission to view the restricted portion of an unrepresented person's social media website or profile. So, for the unrepresented person, you clearly can look at the public portion, but it also, with regard to the unrepresented person, unlike the represented person, you can ask them to make available their restricted portion. You can ask to be a friend. However, and this is if the lawyer is doing it. However, the lawyer must use her full name and an accurate profile, and she may not create a different or false profile in order to mask her identity. Client could do that. Lawyer can't do it. If the person asks for additional information from the lawyer in response to the request that seeks permission to view her social media profile, the lawyer must accurately provide the information requested by the person or withdraw the request. So, under the guidelines, that would be what you would have to do in order not to engage in misrepresentation. Now, there's a fairly lengthy comment to this guideline. I didn't give you all the comments. The whole thing is maybe 20, 25 pages long. But there are a number of state opinions on this, and there's a wide difference of opinion about how much information you have to give if you're communicating with an unrepresented party. Some jurisdictions have said you have to tell the unrepresented party what the matter is about, that you're a lawyer representing X in this matter, that you're contemplating a lawsuit or you filed a lawsuit. So a lot more disclosure than what New York calls for. New York seems to say you have to be truthful, but you don't have to say that you're gathering information for a lawsuit. But maybe it's obvious, maybe it'll be obvious to the represented person if the lawsuit has been filed. They recognize your name, they'll know what it's all about. So maybe it's would be gilding the lily to require more than that. But some jurisdictions do require more than that. Okay, so that's parties. Let me see if anybody wants to raise a question about communication with parties. Yeah.
My firm has an interesting niche in that we've lately been representing a lot of attorneys who are suing on fees that are uncollected. So if I have an attorney for a client,
right,
is he bound by the the client rules or by the attorney rules?
That's a tough question. I had a situation in South Carolina where a lawyer involved in a divorce case. And he wanted to secretly record his spouse, which in South Carolina, with one party consent, you can do it. So if it were an ordinary husband-wife relationship and husband wanted to secretly record wife, would be not a crime or anything in South Carolina to do that. But it's unethical for a lawyer to secretly record. And so the question was, is the lawyer bound by the ethics rules or the lawyer bound by the ordinary rules if the lawyer is acting only in an ordinary client capacity? I think if the lawyer's acting as a client, the client rules ought to apply, not the lawyer rules. Otherwise, why, you know, if you're in an ordinary litigation, why should you be treated more unfairly or unequally than a regular client? But in South Carolina, that's not the case. You're subject to the lawyer rules. I don't know what the situation is in New York. There may be some ethics opinions on that, but I'm not sure of that. Okay, so witnesses. Now, first, you could have situations where a witness would be represented by counsel in the matter. And here, you know, there's a question of interpretation of the rule, because the language of Rule 4.2 says, in representing a client, a lawyer shall not communicate or cause another to communicate about the subject of representation with a party the lawyer knows to be represented. So you could read that to say, if you're dealing with a witness, not a party. And you could even read it more narrowly. You could say, well, if it's a business transaction, there's no party to the business transaction, and that's only for litigation. That I don't think holds up. I think if it's a business transaction, the counterparty would be subject to Rule 4.2. But if it's a witness, that witness is really not a party to any kind of transaction. So maybe Rule 4.2 doesn't apply if you are attempting to communicate with a witness who is represented by counsel. And of course, another issue that could come up is the witness might have a lawyer that regularly represents them, but maybe not in connection with this particular matter, which also is one of the requirements of Rule 4.2. But I would say a cautious lawyer would treat a witness who is represented by counsel as subject to Rule 4.2. And one option that would be available to you if there is a controversy about this is if the court orders or allows informal communications with witnesses who are represented by counsel, then you'd be authorized by law to do it under Rule 4.2, and that's a permissible way in which you can interview a represented person. So that's one question. If the witness is represented by counsel, as a cautious ethics advisor, I would advise you to treat Rule 4.2 as applicable in that situation. Now, if the person is not represented by counsel in the matter, if the witness is not represented by counsel, then clearly you can review the public portion of their site. And since 4.2 doesn't apply in that situation, you could view the private portion. The client could do it, or you could do it, but you would again be subject to that disclosure rule that we talked about before. You have to say who you are, give accurate information about who you are, and so on. Guideline 3B. Okay, any question about witnesses? All right, what about jurors? Third possible category of people that you might think about gathering information from. Here we have a different rule, although the substance of it, I think, is pretty much the same, and that's Rule 3.5A4. This is the ethics rule, 3.5A4, which basically says you can't communicate with a juror or a prospective juror about the case. There's an ABA opinion, 466, which deals specifically with jurors, although the language of it has some implications for the other areas that we've talked about. But in this opinion 466, the ABA said it's proper to use the public portion of a juror's site to gather information. Private portion you can't do because of the anti-communication rule. And in that third category, where it's a public portion, but your viewing it might be communicated to the client, the ABA's view, unlike the New York view, was that was not a communication by the lawyer to the client, and therefore you could view the public portion even if it might be communicated to the client. Again, the New York view is somewhat more restrictive in that respect. One other point about juror viewing of juror sites. If it occurs during the pendency of a case, you might find a juror talking about the case on the website or on the social media site. Do you have to inform the court? Should you inform the court about juror misconduct? And here there's some different possibilities. First of all, if the court had ordered the jury not to speak with anyone about the case, then I think the juror is violating the court order. that's a form of misrepresentation, deceit by the juror. I think that clearly should be reported. If you didn't have something like that, it becomes a little more problematic. At least in other states, it becomes a little more problematic. There's a rule, an ABA rule, that says if a lawyer knows of criminal or fraudulent conduct by a person, the lawyer has an obligation to report it to the court. New York's rule is broader than that. The New York rule actually takes from the old Code of Professional Responsibility rule and says that if a lawyer knows of misconduct by a juror, you have an obligation to report it to the court. Now, I guess the question would be, if the court hasn't ordered the jury not to speak about the case, now I would say in most instances the court would, but if the court hadn't done that for some reason and the juror is posting information about the case, is that, quote, misconduct? I think it ought to be brought to the attention of the court anyway. I think the court needs to, if the court overlooks somehow giving this instruction, then the court needs to be aware that it overlooked the instruction and needs to do something about it, maybe declare a mistrial or something like that.
Are you making any distinctions between a civil or a criminal jury?
No, I think it's the same in either case. We always think of the criminal process as involving liberty and things that are more sacrosanct. So, if you're a prosecutor and you learn about juror misconduct, then because of your obligation to do justice, I think there'd be a heightened obligation to disclose. If you're a defense lawyer and the case is going well for you and, you don't want a mistrial, then it's a more difficult case. So then we'd have to get into the details of it to see whether there might be some wiggle room for not disclosing. Okay, any questions about the area of communication with jurors? All right, another topic in this area is about advising clients to change their social media profile, remove information from the social media profile, change their privacy settings, and so on. Broadly speaking, the New York guidelines, and I think this is reflective of the law generally, say that it's all right for a lawyer to counsel a client about removing media information from the social media profile, changing privacy settings, adding information to it, so long as all of this is truthful. The one big caveat is if litigation is either underway or clearly contemplated, there is this obligation to put in place a litigation hold, which applies both to plaintiff's lawyers and to defense counsel. So you can't be destroying information that would be relevant to the litigation. Can you remove the information from the social media site while keeping copies of it? You're not destroying it, but you're making it more difficult for the other side to access that information. And the answer to that is, I think, absent a court order which says you can't change the social media site, I think you're authorized to do it. I think, there's some risk about having the client having possession of this information that may be incriminating and you trusting the client to safeguard that information. But I think you could do that. And I don't think you violated any ethics rules, so long as there's no court order in place that says that you've got to maintain the site as it is. But you better be careful that you fully instructed the client that anything that's removed has to be maintained and cannot be destroyed. Now that ties into another question about discovery of information on social media sites. All of what we've been talking about up until now is informal discovery, where you're gathering information on your own. But what about a formal discovery request, where you demand that the other side give you access to their social media site? Can you do that? The general view, and there are a couple of New York cases in this area, seems to be that you can't just go into a fishing expedition into someone's social media site. You have to have a factual predicate for being able to gain access to the site. Something that's been disclosed or some reason to believe that there's information there that would be relevant and material to this litigation. I think there was one case where on the public portion of the site, the plaintiff in a personal injury case had disclosed pictures of a skiing trip. And so the defense counsel wanted to have greater access to the social media site because there was some indication that the plaintiff wasn't as seriously injured as she claimed to be. But if it's an ordinary personal injury case, and you say, I want to look at the entire social media site because there may be pictures there that will show that you're not as injured as we think you are, I don't think courts are going to grant that. Because it's a fishing expedition, there's no basis for thinking that there is anything there. There may be something there, but you don't have any factual predicate for it. Now, you know, how much of a factual predicate would be required? Suppose there's information on the social media site, or suppose you got other information showing that the plaintiff went on a trip during a certain period of time. Is that enough to show that there may be information there that would show her physical state? I'm inclined to think not. I think you need to have a little bit more than that, but there's a lot of uncertainty in this area. Okay, comments or questions on that? All right, let me just make a few... Am I going on too long? Okay. A few comments about the advertising area. And that's a big area, and don't have time to go into this in detail, but do want to highlight a couple of things that I think are particularly important with regard to social media sites. And here we're talking about your social media site or your website and what you ought to be concerned about. One problem, this comes up with LinkedIn more than anything else, is ethics rules in New York and in most jurisdictions say you can't use certain magic words like specialization or expertise unless you are a certified specialist. LinkedIn has this category of, I forget the exact language, but skills and expertise or something like that. Can you list the areas you practice under skills and expertise without violating the New York rule? There's New York opinion which says that you can't. You can list that information other places, but you can't list it under skills and expertise. I think that's bad, frankly, because, I mean, the social media sites are not going to structure the way they do things because of lawyers' particular ethical problems. And I think you ought to be able to list your areas of practice, and that's the natural place to put it on LinkedIn. So I think you ought to be able to do it with an appropriate disclaimer on your profile that says something like, LinkedIn uses skills and expertise. That's not meant to be in violation of any rules. These are areas we practice in. Just want you to know that. I think that should be sufficient. But that's pushing the rule a little bit because there are these New York opinions which seem to say you shouldn't be listing under skills and expertise unless you're actually a specialist, a certified specialist in that area.
And, you know, on LinkedIn they have that section that's maybe what you're talking about with the endorsements of people
right.
in certain categories.
Right.
Is there rulemaking on that specific? Does it get that specific?
It does. Yeah. And there you're probably okay under New York because New York says you can have testimonials or endorsements. The major limitation is it's got to be factually accurate. So if someone wants to endorse you as a patent lawyer and you've never practiced patent law in your life, you shouldn't accept that endorsement. But if someone wants to endorse you as a litigator and you do litigation, you can accept that so long as it's factually accurate. Now, in other states, they have much more restrictive rules with regard to testimonials and endorsements. South Carolina, for example, has a more restrictive rule. So there you have to be even a little more careful about how you handle the endorsements. But New York, so long as it's factually accurate, and so long as you haven't paid the person for the endorsement, if it's a paid endorsement, then you've got to disclose that.
Yeah, because these things are, they're almost automated, like the way, you know, LinkedIn, they send people emails and say, hey, is this person good at energy? And,
right.
You know, they're like, oh, yeah, sure they are, you know, and then it comes up as one of the
yeah.
people.
But I think you have to accept it, though.
Yes, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You do have to affirmatively accept it. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, does that cross the line into...
Well, that's my advice is if it's totally outside what you do, then I don't think you should accept it.
But if it's... actually what you specialize in, even though you're not allowed to specialize in anything.
That's fine. And even if it doesn't go that far, if it's an area you have practiced in, and they, and you know, so that you feel comfortable taking something in that area, even though it may not be your main area of practice, I think that's okay.
How do you accept something in LinkedIn? I have a LinkedIn profile, but I don't really.
Well, you'll be notified by a person who's endorsed you, and then you usually
just ignore those.
Well, in a way, you don't want to ignore it. It puts you in a somewhat of a quandary because, first of all, the person who is endorsing you wants an endorsement back. So that puts you in an awkward position where if you don't really like that person or don't trust them very much, you really don't want to endorse them in response. And you also don't want to offend them by ignoring or not responding to their endorsement. So it's a little bit tricky. Generally, I don't endorse other people. And generally, I will accept endorsements so long as I have a reasonable basis for accepting the endorsement. If it's, totally out of left field, if I know the person well, maybe I'll communicate with them. If I don't know the person well, probably I'll ignore it.
I think generally how I handle that stuff is, they're in engineering and so on. They're not lawyers. They think they're doing me solid
right.
by endorsing me for trademark.
Right.
And in the Middle East, trademark protections are pretty laughable. So anybody can go out there and say, yeah, sure, I have trademarks. I've never done it, but it just kind of pops up on the LinkedIn, and they think, oh, I'll do Jason Asala.
Yeah.
And then I get this, and it's like, okay. Generally, how I do it is I'll go and I'll endorse them for something I know that they do, like aerodynamics or something like that.
Right.
And I'll just make a brief note in there saying, by the by, I don't do trademarks. Thanks, I appreciate it. I know what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
I just don't. And that way I'm not hurting their feelings. I'm giving them back kind of what they were looking for anyway.
Right.
And I'm not shooting myself in the head.
Yeah. That's a great way of doing it. Yeah, I like that a lot.
Now, if you specialize in something that there's no way to be certified as a specialist in, say, UAE law.
Mm-hmm.
And the courts in the state of New York aren't going to specialize in that. Now, I'm going to go through my website and look to scrub the word, any variation of the word special anywhere on my website first thing tomorrow morning. Anyway.
Expertise also.
Yeah, expertise. Okay. okay, so I have to scrub the heck out of that thing. But, I mean, say sometime between now and tomorrow morning, I get a letter from a committee saying, hey, we saw this. How do I say, look, there is no way you can get certified as a specialist in this. All I can tell you is I know more about that area of law than you do.
It's an offense that's a non-offense as far as I'm concerned. And I mean, I think you ought to be able to list that under LinkedIn areas of specialization and expertise and skills. Mm-hmm. And I think as long as you had a disclaimer, you should be protected. But even if you don't have a disclaimer, it's not a serious matter to begin with. I mean, the worst that could happen, I think, would be someone would say, you ought to change this.
Okay.
So, I mean, in these technical advertising areas, unless you become really a repeat offender that, shows that you're just going to ignore the rules, the disciplinary authorities are not going to spend their time on these kinds of cases.
In other words, they asked me to change it, and then I doubled down and decided to get billboards and bus benches.
Exactly. I mean, even in South Carolina, where the number, it's not an insignificant number of lawyers, 12,000 lawyers, but still, compared to New York, it's a very small number of lawyers. They're so overwhelmed with advertising complaints. And, of course, the typical complainant in an advertising matter is another lawyer who's feeling he's at a competitive disadvantage because of what the first lawyer is doing. And the way it's handled in South Carolina is they write a letter to the offending lawyer saying you're in violation of the rules, you need to take a CLE course, end of matter. Now, another important area with regard to advertising is past results. If you advertise website, social media, anything like that, anything about past results, whether it's very specific, as in terms of, five multi-million dollar verdicts within the last 5 years, or even more general than that, that you say that we've had very successful results on behalf of clients in quitam cases or something like that. You have to have a disclaimer that says past results are no guarantee of future success. So anything that's result-oriented, you have to have that kind of a disclaimer. You should avoid comparisons to other lawyers. So if you say, I'm the best lawyer in patent law, you got problems, because first of all, you're going to get a complaint from another lawyer about that. And secondly, the rules are when you do that kind of a comparison, you have to factually substantiate it. And how are you going to factually substantiate that you're the best patent lawyer? But what you can do is do something that's just as good, but not comparison. And that is to say experienced or your qualifications or things like that, factual matters that you can present, all of that's fine, and you can't be found to have violated any of the comparison rules. Okay, that's it on advertising, and the floor is open for questions about any of these areas or other ethics areas if you want. Yes?
There's a new web-based company that recently, I think they just launched in the last month, and what they try to do is they match up small business clients with a lawyer in their pre-approved network, and they also provide the clients, I guess, a sort of a guaranteed fee that these lawyers will charge based on certain areas or certain projects. Do you see any ethics or any other types of issues in that scenario?
There are a lot.
Yeah.
So, I mean, first of all, with regard to lawyer referral services that are not bar-sponsored and so on, then there are a lot of court decisions and ethics rules about when that kind of a lawyer referral service, when a lawyer's cooperation with it is proper or improper.
Okay.
Just as one example of the kind of issue that comes up, sometimes those services don't want the lawyers to reveal to the client what the fee is that the lawyer is being paid or what the fee arrangements are. That, in South Carolina, that's been found to be improper because the lawyer is, it's interfering with the lawyer's duty of communication with the client.
Okay. I think the way this one is set up is the lawyer, once the client chooses the lawyer, they have direct contact, but the payments are made from
the client.
Company, the company. The company runs the credit card of the client that pays the lawyer directly, and then the company doesn't collect from that portion, but charges a separate technology fee to the client.
To the client, yeah. Well, yeah, you get into questions of whether it's disguised fee splitting, whether the fee is reasonable. I mean, there are a whole host of issues about that. Hopefully, they had good ethics advice when they were setting this up. But, I mean, there are a range of issues about that.
It sounds risky, but what is the name of the company?
The name? I don't even know if I should say the name. Well, we can talk. They didn't want to join the network, personally, this just happened yesterday, so it's,
yeah.
You know.
If you want to call me, we can talk in more detail about what their framework is and whether there are any problems with it.
Okay.
I was approached when I was in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. I was approached by a similar service about becoming part of their network.
Okay.
I thought, man, they must be talking to everybody because I can't imagine anybody in Philadelphia wanting to set up something in the Roswell Tama Free Zone. Mm-hmm. So I talked with them for a bit, and I got the distinct impression that they didn't take any ethics advice at all. you want to make sure if you have any follow-up conversations with them, kind of try and feel them out maybe. See if they've put any thought into that aspect.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like they have. I mean, I asked them about sort of attorney advertising, about ethics rules, and they did say, the founder said she looked into all of the ethics rules and kind of setting up the structure. And I also...
she an attorney?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Kind of sounds like hireandesquire.com. I don't know if that's it, but
what is it?
Hire and Esquire. Okay, because it's also founded by
is that
kind of like
a legitimate company.
Well, I don't know if define legitimate, but it's actually founded by women, and it's a referral type of service. But I've just been getting their messages. I think the fee structure is a little less complicated than that, but.
And then I wondered if there was any kind of price-fixing issue because they'll list on the site the range, you know, what a certain project may cost.
Mm-hmm.
And so an attorney who agrees to be in the network charges that amount that the company's listed on their site. But the attorney outside of that network can charge whatever they usually charge more or less.
Well, it's kind of like group legal services where there's negotiation with a lawyer to have a reduced fee for participation. I don't know that necessarily is improper, but...
I've been approached by a number of companies very similar. Some of them don't ask for a fee from me at all, but just that I would provide some reduced quasi-pro bono rate.
Mm-hmm. But how do they make their money?
I'm not sure.
They probably charge the other side. I mean, actually, I got
one
yesterday from something
side.
Called Legal Genius.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't follow up, but I mean, it's the same thing where they say, you know, if we accept you into the network, we're not going to charge you.
Right.
But obviously, they've got to collect from somewhere, so they're going to charge the other side, presumably the client. And of course, when you think about it in terms of fees, I mean, fee splitting and all that kind of stuff, I mean, if the client has a budget and says, okay, I'm going to spend no more than X, and their fee is Y, well, then the client is only going to pay you, you know, X minus Y.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, it's a fee splitting economically, but it may not be legally. I don't know.
And of course, one of the long term effects of this is it's putting pressure on lawyers' fees, which, maybe some people think lawyers charge too much, and maybe it's a good thing if lawyers' fees
judges
go down.
Primarily.
Anyway, that's what's happening.
No, but I mean, clients often, care about how much. Certainly they care, but I mean, basically. I've known some clients, particularly in certain industries, that want to pay X amount, and they don't want to pay any more than that.
Right.
Even though, a $10,000 matter takes as much legal time sometimes as a $100,000 matter, or $100,000 and a million, or $10 million, whatever.
Yeah. But I mean, all of this, I mean, a long-term trend is pressure on lawyer services from non-legal providers, pressures on lawyers' fees, and that's an increasing reason why use of technology by lawyers in order to increase the efficiency of delivery of legal services and increase their profit margins, is almost essential, because there are these competitive pressures going on. Anyway, I've enjoyed being... Yes, go ahead.
Okay.
Fine.
This is a little bit off subject, but I'm just curious if they're about email conversations. Probably a little bit off what you were talking about today. Is there anything just generally you can say about preserving email conversations with other counsel, or preserving email conversations?
Well, as a general matter, you have a duty of confidentiality, and you have an obligation to maintain the confidentiality, take reasonable steps to maintain confidentiality of that information. In terms of information that might be discoverable, if you get involved in litigation where your email conversations either with you or with the client or with others are relevant, you have to have those accessible in order to respond to discovery requests if they would be discoverable. Okay, well, I've enjoyed being with you, and any ethics issues that you are interested in talking about, I'd be happy to tell you about. I forgot to mention one other thing. We have an ancillary business of our law firm called Technethics, TechNethics, which is a website devoted to the interrelationship between ethical issues and technology. And it covers cloud computing, e-discovery, international privacy issues, transmission of information through email, and so on. So, if you have ethics problems, that's an important place to go, and take a look at it, and hope you find it useful.
You mentioned an article on cloud computing, I think.
Cloud computing article would be there.
There, okay. Yeah, very interested in that, actually.
And a lot more on cloud computing there as well.
It seems to me like if you follow those rules, or follow what some of the guidelines are about cloud computing, that you can't do business.
This is true.
Yeah.
Due diligence means that you do nothing but diligence.
Right.
So, but the basic rule is reasonableness. And so you're not absolutely liable if for some reason there's a breach of confidentiality. You may have under data disclosure laws or privacy breach laws, you may have an obligation of disclosure, which that in itself can be a pretty daunting task. But in terms of whether you've committed an ethics violation or have legal responsibility, as long as you've acted reasonably, you should be protected. Now, that does raise the whole issue of insurance, cyber insurance for these types of things, and that's a complex area as well.
All right, everyone. Well, thanks for coming, and thanks, Nathan, for the presentation. And I'm sure you know, I'll hang out afterwards if you have any additional questions. And your contact information is on your note sheet if you have follow-up questions. So thanks for coming, everyone.
Sure. Okay. And I do have some information about our firm and also some synopses of this cloud computing article for...
I'll give you one since you expressed interest.
Yeah.